The man seemed consumed by his thoughts, as he often was, especially of late. His glance went to the control modules, the view screen, the path the no-ship had taken along its projected course. Tegg studied the patterns on the console, then the patterns in the emptiness. Even without the no-ship's sensors and view screens, he could grasp the sheer volume of empty space around them. A new void, a different starless region from where they had been. Duncan had made a reckless jump, unguided through fold space. But the nature of randomness was such that any new location was just as likely to be closer to the enemy than farther away. Something troubled him, something he could not ignore. His Atreides-based abilities allowed him to focus on those anomalies and discern what was not there. Duncan wasn't the only one who could see strange things. "Where are we?" Duncan answered with a distant riddle. "Who knows where we are?" He snapped out of his preoccupied trance, then gasped.
"Miles! The net! It's closing in, tightening like a noose!"
Duncan had thrown the ship not to a safe wasteland, but directly into the vicinity of the enemy. Like hungry spiders reacting to unexpected vibrations in their web, the old man and woman were closing in. Already on edge from his simmering premonition, Tegg reacted with a burst of speed, without thinking. His body went into overdrive, his reflexes burning bright, his actions accelerating to indefinable speeds. Moving with a metabolism no human body was meant to withstand, he seized command of the navigation controls. His hands worked in a blur. His mind flashed from system to system, reactivating the Holtzman engines in the middle of their recharge. Immeasurably swift and alert, Tegg became part of the ship and guided them into a sudden and alarming fold space jump. He could feel the gossamer, sentient strands make one last futile grasp, but Tegg tore the ship free, damaging the net as he lurched the huge vessel across a wrinkle in space, jumping to another place and then another, wrenching the craft from the searcher's trap. Behind him, he could sense pain, severe damage to the net and its casters, and then outrage at losing their prey again. Tegg streaked across the bridge, making adjustments, sending commands, moving so swiftly that no one, not even Duncan, would know he was covering for the other man's mistake. Finally, he slowed back to real time, exhausted, drained, and famished. Astonished by what Tegg had done in less than a second, Duncan shook his head to clear away the tar pit memories of Mirbella. "What did you just do, Miles?" Slumped at a secondary console, the Bashar gave Duncan a mysterious smile. "Only what was necessary. We're out of danger." A mere player should never assume he can influence the rules of a game. Bashar Miles Tegg, Strategy Lectures. Snip! The blades of the hedge trimmer clacked together, severing random branches to alter the shape of the greenery. "You see how life persists in straying from its well-defined boundaries?" Annoyed, the old man moved methodically along the high shrub at the edge of the lawn, pruning the outlying stems and leaves, anything that detracted from geometrical perfection. Unruly hedges are so unsettling. With an insistent clicking of the blades, he attacked the tall shrubs. In the end, the planes were perfectly flat and smooth, according to his specifications. Wearing an amused expression, the old woman sat back in her canvas lounge chair. She lifted a glass of fresh lemonade. What I see is someone who persists in imposing order rather than accepting reality. Randomness has value, too. Taking another sip, she thought about mentally activating a set of sprinklers to drench the old man, strictly as a demonstration of unpredictability. But that sort of prank, while amusing, would only provoke unpleasantness. Instead, she entertained herself by watching her companion's unnecessary work. Rather than drive yourself mad with adherence to a set of rules, why not change the rules? You have the power to do so. He glared at her. You suggest I am mad? Merely a figure of speech. You have long since recovered from any sort of damage. You provoke me, Marty. A brief flicker of danger passed as the old man, with renewed vigor, returned his attention to the garden trimmers. He attacked the hedges again, shaping and molding, not satisfied until every leaf was in its desired place. The old woman set her glass down and went to the flower beds where a profusion of tulips and irises added splashes of color. I prefer to be surprised, to savor the unexpected. It makes life interesting. Frowning, she bent over to inspect a bristling weed that thrived among her plants. There are limits, however. With a vicious yank, she uprooted the unwanted plant. You seem quite forgiving, considering that we still do not have the no-ship under our control. It angers me more each time they get away. Kralizek is upon us. That last time was very close. Smiling, the old woman moved through her flower garden. Behind her, the wilting blossoms suddenly brightened, infused with new color. The sky was a perfect blue. You aren't much concerned about the damage they just caused us. I expended a great deal of effort to create and cast the latest tachyon net. Lovely tendrils, far-reaching. He twisted his lips into a scowl. And now everything is torn, tangled, and frayed. Oh, you can recreate it with a thought. The woman waved a tanned hand. You're just annoyed because something didn't happen the way you expected it to. Have you considered that the no-ship's recent escape provides evidence of the prophetic projection? It must mean that the one you expect, whom the humans call the Kwisatz Haderach, is truly aboard. How else could they have slipped away? Perhaps that is proof of the projection. We always knew he was aboard. That is why we must have the no-ship. The old woman laughed. We predict he is aboard, Daniel. There is a difference. Centuries and centuries of mathematical projections convinced us that the necessary one would be there. The old man jammed his sharp hedge trimmers point first into the grass, impaling the lawn as if it were an enemy. The mathematical projection had been so sophisticated and complex that it was tantamount to a prophecy. The two knew full well that they required the Kwisatz Haderach to win the impending typhoon struggle. Previously, they would have considered such a prophecy no more than a superstitious legend spawned by frightened people cowering from the dark. But after the impossibly detailed analytical projections, along with millennia of eerily clever human prophecies, the old couple knew that their victory required possession of the wild card, the human loose cannon. Long ago, others learned the folly of trying to control a Kwisatz Haderach. The old woman stood up from her weeding. She put a hand at the small of her back as if she had a muscle ache, though it was only an affectation. He nearly destroyed them, and they spent 1,500 years bemoaning what happened. They were weak. The old man took a half-full glass of lemonade from where he had set it on an ornate lawn table and drank it down in a single gulp. She went to his side and looked through a razor-edged gap in the hedge toward the extravagant and complex towers and interlinked buildings in the faraway city that surrounded their perfect sanctuary. She touched his elbow. "If you promise not to pout, I can help you repair the net. You really must accept the fact that plans can be disrupted quite easily." "Then we must make better plans." Nonetheless, he joined her in concentration, and they began to weave the gossamer strands through the fabric of the universe once more, reconstructing their tachyon net and sending it out at great speed, covering impossible distances in the blink of an eye. "We will keep trying to catch that ship," the old woman said, "but we might be better off focusing our efforts on the alternative plan that Crone has in mind. Thanks to what was found on Caladan, we do have another option, a second chance to assure our victory. We should pursue both alternatives. We know that Paul Atreides was a Kwisatz Haderach, and a Gola of the boy has already been born, thanks to Crone's foresight. Accidental foresight, I am sure. Nevertheless, he also has the Baron Harkonnen, who will be a perfect fulcrum with which to turn the new Paul to our purposes. Therefore, even if we do not capture the no-ship, we are guaranteed to have a Kwisatz Haderach in our possession. We win either way. I will make certain Crone does not fail us. I have sent special watchers." The old man was powerful and rigid, but at times naive. He did not suspect treachery enough. The old woman knew she needed to keep a better watch on their minions dispersed throughout the old empire. Sometimes the face dancers were too full of themselves. She was happy to let each participant play his role, whether it be the old man, the face dancers, the passengers on the no-ship, or the vast herds of victims standing in the way in the old empire. It amused her for now, but everything was changeable. That was the way of the universe. Plans within plans within plans, like an infinite array of nested reflections cast by angled mirrors. It takes a superior mind to see all of the causes and effects. Crone, message to the face dancer myriad. On Caladan, the strange delegation from far, far outside arrived to see Crone. They did not need to identify themselves when they demanded to learn of his progress with the Baron child and the Atreides Gola they called Paolo. Crone already had what the old man and woman needed, a little boy with all the necessary potential in his gene markers, a Kwisatz Haderach. Instead of rewarding the face dancer, though, the distant puppet masters breathed down his neck, watching everything he did. They wanted complete control, and Crone resented it. The face dancer myriad had suffered from too much domination by fools during the millennia of their existence. Nevertheless, he bided his time. He could deal with these misfit spies. According to the guild manifest and the expertly doctored identification glyphs they carried, the bizarrely augmented humans claimed to come from Ix. It was an acceptable cover story that would explain their odd appearance to any human who happened to see them. But Crone knew that this technology sprang from an entirely different seed, and these ambassadors came from a much greater distance, where the breakwater fringes of the human scattering had crashed against the bulwarks of the enemy. In the past, the meddling masters had pestered him via their interconnected net, but apparently, since the net had recently sustained some damage, the two faraway watchers preferred a less vulnerable communication method. The old man and woman had sent these monstrosities. He wondered if the supposed masters actually meant to intimidate him. Him. The face dancer leader smiled at the very idea as he went to meet the delegation. In the high-ceilinged foyer of the restored Castle Caladan, Crone selected a guise that looked like an old archival painting of Duke Leto Atreides. He dressed in crisp gray clothes of an antique style, checked his appearance in a tall gold plaz-framed mirror, then clasped his hands behind his back as he descended the grand waterfall of stairs to the echoing hall. Stopping on the bottom step, he put on a bland smile and waited coolly to receive the six men. The scarred, pale-skinned representatives were clearly flustered by the physical effort of trudging up the steep walkway from the spaceport. Crone had no incentive to make the journey easier for them, however. He had not asked for their presence and did not intend to make them feel welcome. If the tachyon net was damaged, maybe the old man and woman would not transmit their waves of agony to goad him anymore. And then the face dancers could at last act with impunity. Or maybe not. Uncertain, Crone decided to maintain his docile charade just a while longer. After the strange-looking ambassadors arranged themselves in a clump, Crone looked down at them from the steps on which he stood. "Inform your superiors that you arrived safely." He unclasped his hands, brought them to the front, and cracked his knuckles. "And please inform them that the damage to your bodies was no fault of mine." The men looked confused. "Damage?" The hairless men had pale skin with an oily appearance. Various devices were implanted in their skulls and chests. Primitive electronic gauges, tubing, augmented memory chips, indicator lights. Raw red sores of unhealed wounds surrounded the implants. Everything had such a horrific retrograde feel that Crone had to wonder if this was a subtle and incomprehensible joke played by the old woman. She had a far quirkier sense of humor than her aged companion. "Damage? We were designed this way." "Interesting. My sympathies." The mechanical additions were so primitive that they looked like a child's botched experiment. "Yes," Crone thought, "this has to be a joke. The old woman must be truly bored." "We have come to observe and record." The foremost man stepped away from the cluster. Dark fluid circulated through tubes in the Theng's throat, extending to a pump behind his shoulders. His eyes were a deep metallic blue, showing no whites whatsoever. Another joke, suggesting that he was addicted to melange? "They must be frustrated to have lost the no-ship. Again." Crone gestured for the representatives to enter the castle's great hall. "I certainly hope our masters do not take it out on me. We face dancers are doing an exceptional job, as instructed." "Face dancers should have a greater sense of humility," said another of the augmented delegates. Crone raised his eyebrows. He wondered if his expression matched one the ancient Duke Leto might have made. "Am I remiss as a host?" Come, would you care for refreshments? A feast? He controlled his smile. Or perhaps some much-needed maintenance? We prefer to spend our time collecting and analyzing data so that we can return with a full report. By all means, allow me to facilitate your departure as soon as possible. Krohn led the ambassadors to the castle's laboratory levels. Fortunately, despite the escaped no-ship and the damaged net, everything else is going extremely well. Here in the old empire, my face dancers are undermining the foundations of all human civilization. We have infiltrated every major power group and have begun to turn them against each other. We require proof of this. A strange smell wafted from the first representative's body. Caustic chemicals, halitosis, and a hint of rot. Then open your eyes. Krohn paused in mid-step, calmed his voice, and continued in a more relaxed tone. I invite you to travel among the worlds of the old empire. Your appearance may be alarming to most people, but enough anomalies have crawled back out of the scattering that no one will question you too closely. I can provide a list of key planets and point out what you should look for. They will all be ready to fall like a house of cards as soon as the outside military forces arrive. Have our masters launched the battle fleet yet? Or will they wait until they have the Kwisatz Haderach in hand? That is not for us to say, three representatives said in unison, their augmented minds linked, their voices overlapping in an eerie echo. Then you make it difficult for me to conclude my activities. Why should our masters withhold vital information from me? Perhaps they do not trust you, said another of the hodgepodge representatives. Your progress has been unimpressive so far. Unimpressive? Krohn snorted. I have the Baron Harkonnen Gola, and I have the Paul Atreides Gola. It is guaranteed. At the entrance to the thick-walled laboratory chambers, Krohn unsealed and hauled open a heavy door. Inside, a somewhat plump 10-year-old jerked to his feet, looking around warily with piggish eyes, as if he'd been caught doing something he shouldn't. Recovering quickly, the adolescent snickered at them, captivated by the horrifically mangled observers. Krohn did not speak a word to the Gola, but turned back to the six representatives. You see, the next phase of our plan is imminent. I expect to restore this Baron's memories soon. You can try to do it, the youth spat at him. But you haven't yet convinced me that it's to my benefit. Why won't you let me play with little Paolo? I know you're keeping him here on Caladan. Exactly why do we need the Baron Harkonnen? Asked one of the hideous observers, ignoring the boy. Our masters are interested only in the Kwisatz Haderach. The Baron will help us facilitate this. He will be like a wrecking bar to the Paolo Gola. After he becomes himself again, our Baron will be a valuable tool to unlock the powers of the superhuman. Historically, the problem with a Kwisatz Haderach is one of control. Once he helps me raise Paolo properly, I am confident the Baron can assure our hold on him. The young man grinned at the newcomers. You certainly are ugly. What happens if you pull out those tubes? He does not seem cooperative, observed one of the spies. He will learn better. Reawakening Agola's memories is a very painful process, Crone said, still ignoring the young Harkonnen. I greatly look forward to the task. The Baron Gola let out an eager laugh that sounded like twisting metal. I can't wait for you to try. Crone paused at the door, reminding himself to keep all security systems in place, especially with the Mercurial Baron, who was quite prone to mischief. Crone led the delegation of nightmarish humans into another room and carefully locked the chamber behind him. He did not want Vladimir Harkonnen to run loose. Our Atreides, Gola, is progressing nicely. Before entering the castle's main chamber, Crone turned a cool stare toward the hideous patchwork people. Our victory is foreordained. Soon I will go to Ix to complete another step in the plan. Crone meant victory for the face dancers, but the ambassadors would interpret it as they wished. The rest is just a formality. Reputation can be a beautiful weapon. It often spills less blood. Bashar Miles Teg, First Incarnation. Foremost among the Mother Commander's weapons were her flesh-and-blood fighters. The rebel-honored Matres on Gamu wouldn't have a chance against the Valkyries. They had made a serious mistake in attempting to strike Chapter House with their obliterators. After their attack failed, the dissidents on Gamu had expected Mirbella to overreact and retaliate instantly. But she had exercised the meticulous care and patience she'd acquired from her Bene Gesserit training. Now, striking back after a month's delay, she knew that every aspect of the plan was perfectly arranged. Before setting off for Gamu, she reviewed and revised her options based on the latest intelligence reports, as well as the information she had gleaned from sharing with Priestess Iriel before she died. It was still unclear whether or not the renegade whores would make a suicidal stand on Gamu, triggering any last obliterators they possessed, rather than let the world fall to the new sisterhood. This would be Mirbella's most critical battle to date, the toughest enclave of rebels. Alone with the responsibilities of supreme command, she stood high atop the western rampart of Chapter House Keep. The attack itself and victory would occur swiftly. More than just excising the festering sore of rebel-honored Matres, the new sisterhood needed the Gamu military-industrial complex for further defenses against the oncoming enemy. Mirbella had already sent in operatives to soften the resistance. Secret assassins, adept disseminators of propaganda, and members of the Missionaria Protectiva to rally the ever-growing religious groups against the whores who killed the blessed Shiana on Rakis. It was exactly what Duncan Idaho would have done. The honored Matres on Gamu were led by a charismatic and bitter woman named Niella, who boldly claimed to trace her ancestry back to House Harkonnen. An obvious lie, since honored Matres were unable to traverse the webs of other memory and could not remember their predecessors. Niella had made her claim only after spending time digging through old records from the days when Gamu was a grimy industrial planet called Gaiety Prime. Even after so long, the local population held a visceral hatred for the Harkonnens. Niella apparently used that to her advantage. The honored Matres had set up extensive defenses on Gamu, including sophisticated scanners to detect and destroy incoming aircraft and missiles, specifically tailored to foil the new sisterhood's traditional mode of attack. For the time being, small gaps remained in their coverage, especially in the least populated regions of the planet. Janess assured the Mother Commander she could bring their forces in through one of the gaps and mount an overwhelming surprise attack. For the first time, her fighting women would rely primarily on their swordmaster skills. After gathering all their ships and summoning guild transport, the Valkyries launched. From the night side of Gamu, scores of troop transports disembarked from an orbiting no-ship and headed down toward a region of broad, frigid plains. Flying only meters above the icy ground, Mirbella's ship raced overland toward the capital city of Yesai. Behind them, a formation of small troop shuttles cruised along like a school of hungry piranhas. Under her direction, the stealth shuttles, flown by the Sisterhood's best pilots, paused just long enough to release their swarms of female commandos into the city, and then streaked off without firing a shot, triggering no alarms. Just shy of dawn, Mirbella and thousands of her black-uniformed sisters filtered into Yesai to engage the defenders from the inside out, attacking where they were least expected. Although the entrenched Hoars had anticipated a large-scale lightning assault with attack thopters and heavy weaponry from above, the Sisterhood's commandos fought like scorpions from the shadows, striking, stinging, killing. The hand-to-hand combat made famous by the ancient swordmasters of Ganaz required no technology more sophisticated than a sharp blade. The Mother Commander chose her own target after reviewing the personal habits of honored Matre Niella. Accompanied by a small guard of fighters, Mirbella ran directly to Niella's ostentatious apartment near the central guild bank buildings in Yesai. The Valkyries in their combat single suits seemed to be cloaked in black oil. Half of the assassination operations were over before the Hoars managed to sound the first alarms. Brightly clothed, honored Matres guarded the entrance to Niella's dwelling, but Mirbella and her companions struck in force, firing silent projectiles that hit their marks. Mirbella bounded up an interior stairway, followed by Janess and her most trusted fighters. On the second level, a tall, athletic woman emerged from shadows in the hall. Dressed in a purple leotard and a cape adorned with chains and sharp crystal shards, she moved with the grace of a predatory feline. Mirbella recognized Niella from Priestess Iriel's vivid memories. "Strange. You don't look at all like Baron Harkonnen," she said. "Perhaps some of his most prominent features did not breed true. Maybe that's a good thing." As if springing an ambush, fully 50 honored Matres emerged from doorways to take up protective positions around Niella, arrogantly assuming the smaller assault squad would buckle and retreat upon seeing them. Like a deadly dance, the well-trained Valkyries paired off against them, flashing blades in their hands and sharp spines in their combat suits. Mirbella had eyes only for Niella. The two leaders faced off, circling. The other women seemed to expect a softened Mother Commander to cringe at the prospect of combat. The honored Matre leader suddenly kicked out with a calloused and deadly foot, but Mirbella moved faster and eluded the blow. In a blur of motion, she counterattacked from one side with her fists and elbows, backing her adversary away. Then Mirbella laughed, which unnerved her opponent. In an unrestrained response, the honored Matre threw herself at Mirbella, fingers outstretched like knives, but Mirbella thrust up with her left elbow, catching Niella with the armored spine protruding from her combat suit. The slice shed blood down Niella's arm. Mirbella landed a solid kick in the other woman's solar plexus, driving her back into the wall. Bumping into the stone barrier, Niella slumped as if beaten. She sprang to one side and darted back, but Mirbella was ready for her, countering every move, driving Niella backward until she had nowhere left to go. Even her honored Matre followers could not resist the dizzyingly swift fighting techniques that the mother commander had drilled into her soldiers. All 50 of the guards were dead, leaving their leader alone and defeated. "Kill me," Niella spat the words. "I'll do worse." Mirbella smiled. "I will take you to Chapter House as my prisoner." The following day, the victorious Mother Commander marched through the streets of Yasai and mingled with curious crowds. The cult of Shiana had taken firm root here, and the Gamu natives saw their liberation as a miracle, interpreting the army of sisters as soldiers fighting for their beloved martyr. Noting various clear behavioral markers, Mirbella suspected that some women in the crowd were actually honored matres who would change their distinctive clothes. Were they cowards? Or the seeds of a fifth column who would continue to resist on Gamu? Even with the signs of victory around her, Mirbella knew that the fighting and consolidation would continue for some time, if not in Yasai itself, then in the outlying cities. She would have to assign teams to root out any remaining nests of rebels. She was not the only one to notice the lurking honored matres. Her agents surged forward, making arrests, thinning the crowd. Anyone captured would be given the opportunity to convert. Niella herself would begin enforced training back on Chapter House. Those who didn't cooperate would be put to death. Mirbella's triumphant forces took more than 8,000 honored matres back to Chapter House, and more would follow after the mop-up operations were completed under the direction of Jeunesse. The conversion process would be difficult and monitored closely by troops of truthsayers and now loyal honored matres, but no more difficult than the original forced unification. The Mother Commander could not afford to discard so many potential fighters, despite the risk. Thus, the new sisterhood grew even stronger, with more and more numbers added to their forces. 16 years after escape from Chapter House. Is love born to us? As natural a part of our humanity as breathing and sleeping? Or is love something we must create within ourselves? Mother Superior Darwi O'Draid, Private Bene Gesserit Records, censored. 2 more years passed aboard the no-ship. Paul Atreides, his body now 10 years old, his mind stuffed full of all the external memories the library archives could provide and the histories of what he was supposed to be, walked with the girl Chaney. She was rail-thin and petite, 2 years his junior. Though she had grown up far from the arid wastelands of Arrakis, her body's metabolism still did not squander water, genetically adapted from her Fremen heritage. Chaney wore her dark red hair pulled back in a braid. Her brown skin was smooth and her mouth quick to flash a smile, especially when she was with him. Her eyes were a natural sepia, not the blue-within-blue eyes of spice addiction, which Paul had seen in every historical image of an older Chaney, the beloved concubine of Muad'Dib and mother of his twin children. As they descended from one deck to another, making their way to the aft engine section of the great no-ship, Paul let his hand slip into hers. Though they were still just children, it seemed a comfortable thing to do, and she did not pull away. All their lives they had played together, explored together, and never questioned that they were supposed to be partners, just like in the old stories. "Why do you find the engines so fascinating, Usul?" she said, calling him by the Fremen name that she had learned from her own diaries and journal recordings in the ship's archives. In ancient, preserved poetry, the first Paul Muad'Dib had described Chaney's voice as the perfectly beautiful tones of fresh water chuckling over rocks. Listening to her now, the new Paul could see how he had once come to that conclusion. The Holtzman engines are so strange and powerful, able to take us anywhere we can imagine going. He reached out to tap her small, pointed chin with his fingertip, then said in a conspiratorial whisper, "Or maybe the real reason is because nobody watches us in the engine rooms." Chaney's brow furrowed. "On a ship this size, there are plenty of places for us to be alone." Paul shrugged, smiling. "I didn't say it was a very good reason. I just wanted to go there." They entered the giant engineering bay where, in normal times, only certified guildsmen could go. Under the present circumstances, Duncan Idaho, Miles Tegg, and some reverend mothers knew enough about these fold space engines to keep them functioning. Fortunately, no ships were so exquisitely and sturdily built that little went seriously wrong, even after so many years without standard upkeep. The Ithaca's major operating systems and self-repair mechanisms were sufficient to perform regular maintenance. The more important the component, the more redundancy was designed into it. Nevertheless, both Tegg and Duncan, using their Mentat abilities, had set about studying and memorizing all known specifications of the immense vessel to prepare themselves for any crisis that might occur. Paul supposed Thufir Hawat would also contribute his wisdom once he grew up and became a Mentat again. Now the boy and girl stood surrounded by throbbing machinery. Although the no-field projectors were located in different parts of the ship, with repeaters and reinforcing stations mounted throughout the hull, these giant engines were similar to the fold space designs that had been used back in the time of Muad'Dib, and much earlier in the Butlerian Jihad. T.O. Holtzman's then dangerous fold space engines had been the key to ultimate victory over the thinking machines. Paul stared up at the massive machines, trying to sense their driving mathematical force, though he didn't understand it all. Chaney, a few inches shorter than he, surprised him by standing on her tiptoes and kissing his cheek. He spun to face her, laughing. She saw the surprise on his face. "Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? I've read all the files. We're destined for each other, aren't we?" Growing serious, Paul held her small shoulders and gazed into her eyes. Then he reached out to stroke her left eyebrow and drew his fingers down her cheek. He felt awkward doing this. "It's strange, Chaney, but I can sense a tingle, or a tickle. I feel it too. A memory just beneath the surface." He kissed her on the brow, experimenting with the sensation. "Proctor Superior Garimi made us read our history in the archives, but those are just words. We don't know it here." He tapped his chest over the heart. "We can't know exactly how we fell in love before. We must have said a lot of private things to each other." Her lips formed a frown, not quite a little girl's pout, but rather an expression of concern. Her accelerated education and maturity made her seem much older than her years. "Nobody knows how to fall in love, Usul. Remember the story? Paul Atreides and his mother were in terrible danger when they joined the Fremen. Everyone you knew was dead. You were so desperate." She drew a quick breath. "Maybe that's the only reason we fell in love." He stood close to her, embarrassed, not knowing what he was supposed to do. "How can I believe that, Chaney? A love like ours was the stuff of legend. That doesn't happen by accident. I'm just saying that if we are to fall in love again when we get older,
then we'll have to do it ourselves. Do you think we're getting a second chance?
All of us are. She hung her head.
Of the things I've read, the saddest was the story of our first baby, our original son, Leto.
Paul was surprised at the lump that automatically formed in his throat. He had read his old journals about their baby boy. He'd been so proud of their little son. But because of his damnable prescience, he had known that the first little Leto would be killed in a Harkonnen raid. That poor boy had never had a chance, hadn't even lived long enough to be christened Leto II, after Paul's father. According to the records, his second son, the infamous one, had been willing to go down the dark and forbidding path where Paul himself had refused to go. Had Leto II made the right choice? The God Emperor of Dune had certainly changed the human race and the course of history for all time.
I'm sorry. I made you sad, Usul.
He took a step away from her. Around them, the engine room seemed to vibrate with anticipation. Everyone hates our Leto II because of what he turned into. He did very bad things, according to history. The first Chaney had died in childbirth, barely living long enough to see the twins.
Maybe he'll get a second chance, too, she said.
The gola of the little boy was now 4 years old and already showing unusual acuity and talent. Paul took her hand and impulsively kissed her on the cheek. Then they both left the engine room. This time, our son could do things right. The day hums sweetly when you have enough bees working for you. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, the original. In a state of high agitation, the 12-year-old boy gazed out on a pristine meadow of colorful flowers. A waterfall cascaded over a rocky precipice and splashed into an icy blue pool. Too much of this so-called beauty was painful and unsettling. The air carried no industrial chemicals. He hated even to breathe the stuff into his lungs. To break the boredom and work off some of his energy, he had gone for a long walk, kilometers from the compound where he had been sentenced to live on the planet Dan. Caladan, he reminded himself. The curtailed name offended him. He had read his history and seen images of himself as the old, fat baron. Exiled here for 3 years now, the young Vladimir Harkonnen found he missed the laboratories of Tlilox, Matre Superior Helica, and even the smell of slig excrement. Trapped here, tutored and trained and prepared by the humorless face dancers, the boy was impatient to make his mark. He was, after all, important to the plan, whatever it was. Shortly after he'd been sent away to Caladan for the trivial crime of sabotaging the axolotl tank holding the gola of Paul Atreides, the new baby had been born in Bandalong. Healthy, despite Vladimir's best efforts. Krohn had whisked the infant Atreides away from Uxtal and brought him to Caladan for training and observation. Apparently, the face dancers had something vital for the Atreides to accomplish, and they needed a Harkonnen to help them achieve it. The child, named Paolo to distinguish him from his historical counterpart, was 3 years old now. The face dancers took great care to keep him in a separate facility, safe from Vladimir, who couldn't wait until the two of them could play together. In times gone by, Caladan had been a world of simple fishermen, vintners, and farmers. With its immense ocean, Caladan had too much water and too little land to support large commercial industries. These days, Most of the villages were gone, and the local population had dwindled to a small percentage of what it had once been. The scattering had broken many threads that bound a multi-galactic civilization together, and since Caladan produced little of commercial value, no one wanted to bring the planet back into the overall tapestry. Vladimir had done a considerable amount of research in the reconstructed castle. According to the written history, House Atreides had ruled this place with a firm yet benevolent hand, but the boy knew better than to believe that propaganda. History had a way of sanitizing the truth, and time distorted even the most dramatic events. The local files had obviously been padded with laudatory comments about Duke Leto. Since the Atreides and Harkonnens were mortal enemies, he knew that his own house must have been the truly heroic of the two. When young Vladimir got his memories back, he would be able to recall such things firsthand. He wanted to re-experience the events with visceral truth. He wanted to know the treachery of the Atreides and the valor of the Harkonnens. He wanted to feel the adrenaline rush of real victory and taste the blood of fallen enemies on his fingers. He wanted the memories restored now. It galled him that he had to wait so long before having his past life triggered. Alone in the meadow, he played with an inferno gun he had found at the castle compound. This lush, natural environment of the seashore headlands disgusted him. He wanted machines to plow it under and pave it over. Make way for real civilization. The only plants he wanted to see were factory buildings sprouting up. He hated clean water spilling all over the place, wanted to see manufactory chemicals darken it and give it a sulfurous odor. With a fiendish grin, Vladimir activated the gun and saw its muzzle glow orange in his hands. He touched the yellow button for the first stage burner and watched a fine mist of concentrated incendiary particles spread over the meadow, the seeds of destruction. Moving to a safer area of rock, he tapped the red second stage button, and an immense blowtorch vomited from the weapon's barrel. The flammable particles caught fire, transforming the entire meadow into a conflagration. Beautiful. Filled with malignant glee, he scurried to a higher vantage point and watched the flames burn and crackle, sending smoke and sparks hundreds of meters into the air. On the other side of the meadow, fire licked up the rock face as if searching for prey. It burned with such intensity that the heat cracked the stone itself, causing large chunks to fall into the peaceful pool in a loud cascade. Much better. The ambitious young man had seen holopictures of Gamu and compared them with images of its earlier incarnation as Geaty Prime under the Harkonnens. Over the centuries, his ancestral home had been ruined, falling into a state of agricultural primitivity. The hard-fought signs of civilization had faded into soft squalor. Now, with the cleansing odors of fire and smoke filling his nostrils, he wished he had bigger inferno guns and massive equipment, the means to reshape this entire planet. Given time, tools, and a proper workforce, he could turn backwater Caladan into a civilized place. In the process, he could torch vast expanses of the verdant landscape to make way for new manufactories, landing fields, strip mines, and metals processing plants. The mountains in the distance were ugly, too, with their white-capped summits. He would like to flatten the whole range with powerful explosives, cover it with factories to produce goods for export. And profit. Now that would really put Caladan on the galactic map. He would not entirely destroy the ecosystem, of course. Not the way the honored Matres did with their planet burners. In remote areas, Unsuitable for industry, he would leave enough plants to maintain the oxygen levels. The seas would have to provide enough fish and kelp for food because importing supplies from off-world was prohibitively expensive. Caladan was such a waste now. How unadorned this world was, but how beautiful it could be with a little work. A great deal of work, actually. But it would be worth the effort, sculpting the homeworld of his mortal enemies, House Atreides, to his own vision. A Harkonnen vision. These sensations and fantasies made him feel much, much better. Vladimir wondered if his memories might be ready to come back, a little at a time. He hoped so. Hearing a clatter of stones behind him, he turned. "I've been watching you at play," Crone said. "I am pleased to see you thinking along correct lines, just as the old Baron Harkonnen did. You will need some of these techniques when we place Paolo in your care." "When do I get to play with him?" "Your own survival depends on certain things. Understand this. Helping us with the Paul Atreides Gola is the most important objective of your entire life. He is the key to our many plans, and your survival depends upon how well he does." Vladimir formed a feral smile. "It is my destiny to be together with Paolo, and to succeed with him." He kissed the face dancer passionately on the mouth, and Crone pushed him away. Inside, Vladimir was not smiling at all. Even in this odd reenactment of his life, he still felt the need to strangle the Atreides Gola. The meek see potential threats everywhere. The bold see potential profits. Chome Administrative Memo. More pain, more torture, more spice substitute. Still no success. Not even anything that qualified as minor progress in making melange with the axolotl tanks. In other words, business as usual. Uxtal worked in his Bandalong laboratories, serving the needs of the honored Matres. At least the two brats had been gone for years now, two less things to be terrified about. In his quarters, he had marked off more days and searched for ways to change his situation, to escape, to hide. But none of his solutions seemed remotely viable. With the exception of God, he hated everyone who held authority over him. Beyond the things his superiors wanted from him, beyond the excuses and lies he told them about what he was doing, Uxtal searched for signs and portents, numerical patterns, anything to reveal to him the significance of his own holy mission. He had survived for so long in nightmare that there must be a purpose behind it. Since taking away the newborn Paul Atreides Gola, the face dancers had not commanded him to do anything further for them, yet the little researcher felt no relief. He was not free. They were sure to come back and demand something even more impossible. The honored Matres still pressured him to produce real melange with axolotl tanks, so he performed extravagant sham experiments to demonstrate how hard he was working, though completely without success. Now that the face dancers no longer seemed to care about him, he was completely at the mercy of Matre Superior Helica. He squeezed his eyes tightly shut and considered how difficult his life had been for so many years. Since the new sisterhood had conquered most of their other strongholds, the honored Matres needed less and less of the adrenaline-based drug. That did not make life easier for him, though. What if the terrible women got it into their heads that they didn't require him at all anymore? He had achieved nothing new in quite some time and was sure they were convinced he would never make melange. He had been convinced of that himself for several years now. Focused on business above all else, guild ships and Chome merchants flew in and out of the devastated zones on Tlilox. Necessarily neutral in the conflict, they traded without playing politics. Honored Matres required certain supplies and off-world items, especially with their extravagant tastes in clothing, jewels, rare foods. Once, the whores had been fabulously wealthy, controlling the guild bank and carrying valuable currencies with them as they swept across star systems and planets, leaving scorched earth in their wake. Uxtal did not understand them, could not comprehend what could have created such monsters or what had chased them out of the scattering. As usual, no one told him anything. When the guild navigators approached Helica and her entrenched rebels on Tlilox with a proposal, Uxtal just knew his nightmare was about to get worse. A messenger arrived in Bandalong from a high-orbiting highliner. Helica herself came to escort Uxtal past the suspicious stares of Ingva and the brow-beaten lab workers. "Uxtal, you and I will travel to meet with Navigator Edric. He awaits us aboard the Highliner." Though confused and intimidated, Uxtal could not argue. A navigator? He gulped. He had never seen one of them before. He did not know why he was being singled out for such attention, but it couldn't be good news. How had the navigator learned of his existence? Through prescience? He wondered if this might be an opportunity for him to escape, or get a reprieve, or be saddled with another impossible task. Aboard the guild ship, though no one could overhear them inside the shielded chamber, Uxtal still did not feel safe. He stood silent.